Accession number 18573, Reel 4.
Fred Wernard, Reel 4.
How far did we get? Yeah. Every single night, we were staying at the hotel there, where we were billeted. You just got into your bed. Half an hour later, the sirens went off, so you had to go down into the cellar of the hotel. And you could hear it. It went on for about an hour. Bombs were dropping like peas. Literally hundreds of them. It was terrifying, because even in the cellar, everything was shaking all the time. And we were then seconded after the raid. Instead of going back to your bunk, you had to go out rescuing people in the town. You had to help with fire brigade and all the rest. Because you very often came across somebody up on the third floor, everything else fell around their ears. There was just a skeleton of a ruin left there, and there was somebody up on the third floor shouting for help. And that's where we came in, with fire brigade helping, you know, let us up and rescuing people. We had to do that all the time we were stationed in Bremen.
Now, you only did one operation, you said, with U-123.
Yeah.
Do you remember your first operation with U-187?
Very well. Very well indeed. Yep. We went round between the Orkneys, between the Faroes and, which is Orkneys, no, the Shetlands, is it?
The Shetlands. The
Shetlands is the next one down. Anyway, we went around there. We got as far as going through there. It sounds like going through a little tunnel, but it's I don't know how many miles apart. But a Sunderland flying boat spotted us. That was their job, so I subsequently found out, apparently, because a lot of German U-boats used to go between the Shetlands and Faroes into the Atlantic, because going through the channel was a bit dangerous. So we had to go around the top. And when they spotted us, down come the bombs, and we had to go back to Germany, because we had damage to the conning tower and the periscope. So we had to go back to Germany to be refitted.
What did it feel like when the Sunderland attacked?
Terrible. Frightening. Well, I was anyway. Especially me, I think. I have an excuse for being more frightened than others. Because my little, what I used to call my little cubby hole, was only about roughly a yard square. And I was completely shut in there. And all this was going on. And you could hear water coming in. And you couldn't see it, I could hear it. And people shouting all the time. And you were stuck in a little cubby hole. So I was terrified. Simple as that.
Which year was this in, do you think?
The end of... the end of 43. Yeah. That's right. End of 43, because we were... The captain was on the carpet for this incident. He was called for the admiral. He was on the carpet simply because the periscope was damaged. And they were very hard to come by. Because the factory, Zeiss Icon, who actually made them, they were bombed. So there was a limited supply. So anything like that being damaged, obviously, was a bit of a hardship. So he was on the carpet. But anyway, we were refitted. Back we went up there. Only next time we went underwater. We didn't chance it again.
Who was the captain of this boat?
Münich, his name was. Captain Münich.
How did he compare with the other one? Thompson?
He didn't. Thompson was a captain. Münich was a learner. He got married just before we set out. The whole crew went to his wedding. And he was sitting in his cabin very often, that is my estimation anyway, when he was required on the bridge, he was looking at the photograph of his wife when he was required on the bridge. So to me, that's the way I saw it anyway, he wasn't what I call a dynamic captain. You will find out later when we really copped it where he failed.
How many operations did you did with this boat, 187?
One and a half. The half was when we got sunk.
Can you tell me about that half an operation, please?
I can tell you about the half operation, vividly. I will never forget it. The order was what I might call free range, Atlantic free range. In other words, seek out thy enemy. Roam around, see what you can find. Which was unusual, because normally every boat had orders to go to a certain sector and operate in that sector on the map. We were told, free range, go where you like, within, obviously, within a certain area in the Atlantic, see what you can find. Well, we did find. We went as far as Greenland, found nothing. We came down the coast of Canada. We got as far as, or off the coast, obviously. When I say coast, I mean several miles off the coast. As far as the St. Lawrence River, or the entrance of, which is several miles wide, we spotted a convoy coming out. So it was my job as radio operator to radio back to base in France, spotted convoy. Back came order, keep in touch and report. Well, that, keep in touch and report, meant suicide to everybody, immediately. Only they didn't know it, because as wireless operator, I wasn't at liberty to tell anybody except the captain. As soon as the message came through, I handed my sheet of paper to him. He read it and destroyed it. Dunked it in water and it was destroyed. Anyway, it meant suicide, because we knew by having to report meant you weren't allowed to dive. You had to surface, stay on the surface, see what you can see and report. Well, that to me meant British radio was so far advanced by then, that was beginning of 43 now.
Beginning of 44?
Where are we? 44, January 44. They were so far advanced in their radar that as soon as you sent a message, they got you. Because one little bleep on the transmitter, they honed in on it. And therefore, their radar scanned the horizons and said, oh, there's something there. And they went for it with the destroyers, full tilt. That's what happened. Anyway, we reported, we spotted this, report back. We reported back. The last message I personally sent was six destroyers, among them by name Jimmy and Harvester. Others, I don't know the names of, but the two were involved, you will find subsequently, Jimmy and Harvester. And we counted 94 ships all in all, in that convoy. Once we reported that, they already spotted us. It was Jimmy, in fact, that spotted us and made full tilt for us. Well, the way I see it, any captain on the ball would have dived immediately as soon as the attack started, which I could hear on my underwater listening device. As soon as the engines start, because radar can't operate unless they stand still. Radar operates, they get the target, then they start off. Because when the engines are running, they drown out the radar signal, you see. So they got to stand still to send out the signals. which they did. And as soon as you hear it on our hull, you hear it ping, ping, ping. That's how it goes, as loud as that. Then you know you are in their radar. Anyway, they came for us. Any normal captain would have dived immediately and go either hard starboard or whatever, take evasive action. The time it takes the destroyer to get the position he actually caught you in, you're somewhere else. In other words, cat and mouse. Then he stands still again, bing, bing, he got you again. You do the same again, depending how quick you are in your evasive action. Well, obviously my captain, the way we had four survivors all in all, and all four agreed. He was so wrapped up with his young wife, which he married before he went out. The whole crew went to the wedding, by the way. And he was sitting in his cabin looking at her photograph. While depth charges were dropping, he was still sitting in there, rather than being in the, what do you call it now, the central...
Control room?
Control room. Glad you helped me out there. In the control room, he was still sitting in there. The first officer had to call him. That's when he came up. Anyway, by then, obviously, they knew we were there. I counted, it was part of my job as well as operator, to log every depth charge, the time. Well, I counted 182 altogether. By then, we were a wreck. And so was I. I then threw my pencil on the floor and... as well as it, I had enough then. Anyway, it wasn't long after water was coming in, sort of all directions, through the valves that blew out through the pressure of the depth charges, because some of them were very, very close. And if they're very close, the water pressure is such that it blows out valves, the pressure itself. And if you have a lot of water coming in, it becomes very dangerous. I mean, you don't think of drowning, that's the last thing you think about. The batteries we have, 84 of them, big batteries, alkaline batteries, they come in contact with seawater, they give off poisonous fumes. And water was coming in all directions. So what you were worried about mainly is water getting to the batteries. Those fumes come up, it's your lot anyway. Anyway, we went down over the propellers because we had one or two close hits. So we went down sinking a little bit. How far down exactly, I wouldn't know. I was in no state to find out. And command came, abandoned ship. Water was then coming in sort of quite a bit all over the place. So the only thing out was, canning tower was out, it was damaged, you couldn't open the hatch. Obviously had a near hit or whatever, and it was bent. The torpedo loading bay had the same trouble, couldn't open the hatch. So the last resort was the torpedo tube. That's what I did.
How do you get out of the torpedo tube?
Very simple. You crawl in, shut it up, flood it. In other words, you equal the pressure inside the tube to the pressure outside. I mean, you train for that anyway. And then you open the outside thing, which there's a lever on inside the Bosnian anyway. You open it, and you just float out. And depending how deep you are, and I can't tell you how deep exactly we were, because we've lost so much compressed air, which is vital to U-boat operating up and down, because it's all done with compressed air. When you go down, you flood your tanks with water, you go down. When you want to come up, you extrude the water with compressed air. And we've used quite a bit of it trying to avoid the destroyers. So there was much left. So we couldn't quite make it to the surface. So we floated out. The trick then is, if you don't know how deep you are, you stop every... You float a little way up and stop. As before, lungs, pressure on the lungs. And eventually, anyway, you get to the surface. Which I did. I was then, after guessing again, obviously, you don't have time to look at your watch, even if it works, after what seemed to me an age, we were rescued by the destroyer Jimmy. Now, take into account, it was the end of January in the Atlantic. It was just a little bit cold. My hands were like this, stiff. They threw a line into somebody in the water, and the swell was quite eight. In other words, a swell of about 30 feet. So you sort of up and down, and anyway, they threw the line from the destroyer. I wrapped it around my hands and was hanging on, and they started pulling me up. I got halfway up, and from down there, a destroyer seems pretty high up. They pulled halfway up. Of course, I couldn't hold it. My hands were so frozen, so obviously I had to let go. Down I went again. But they were persistent. They didn't give up. Lucky for me, they threw another line. This time I managed to put it around my midriff. I couldn't tie a knot. I was so already frozen. I managed to just slip it under once. And as they pulled, it tightened. So I was lucky. And the rope was wet anyway by then. And as it tightened, it held me. And they pulled me up. There was this chap. He was built like a barn door. To me, he looked like a giant. He was well over 6 foot. He had a pair of shoulders like a barn door. He grabbed me by the scruff of my neck and lifted me and stood me on deck. Now, that terrified me even more, because he was so big and strong, and I felt so little and vulnerable. I thought he was going to wring my neck and then throw me back. But anyway, the first thing he did, he stripped me naked. Now, I thought, now, there's a funny chap. Now, what he did, he stripped me naked, laid me on deck, because I was absolutely frozen stiff. I don't know what I looked like, but I must have been blue. I mean, at that time of year in the Atlantic, it is cold. And he got the hip flask out with rum and poured it over me and got a towel and started rubbing me. You know, within a minute, I was on fire. I still believe it saved me. I believe so, anyway. The next thing he did, the blankets around me, took me to a cabin, immediately gave me a whole pack of, what were they called? Senior service cigarettes. Yeah, he gave me a packet of cigarettes, he brought me an orange, and he brought me a block of very dark chocolate. It was very bitter, very dark chocolate. Now, I subsequently found out that the crew of that destroyer, they were living on hard rations, which meant corned beef and biscuits. He gave me chocolate and an orange. The story becomes even better. This very same chap I met, how long later?
Oh, years later, but 5 years.
Must be 3 years later. 4 years later, yes, must be 4 years later, I met this very same chap in Norwich.
Was he a Norwich man?
He was a Norwich man.
How did you come to meet him?
That's another story. I don't know if you want to hear it.
Please.
Right. When I came back from Germany in 1949, I by then had my license to practice dentistry in Germany, which I did. With my wife by my side. Coming back to England, I applied for a license to practice to the registrar of the Dental Association through a Norwich solicitor. And they got as far as they examined everything, and they couldn't make up their mind whether to give me a BDS or an LDS. The difference being, the BDS would be the equivalent of a German doctorate, which I didn't have. The LDS is the equivalent of a dentist, the old-fashioned dentist, which doesn't exist anymore. Anyway, I didn't care which anyway. All I wanted to do is pursue my profession. But within a week after being told they couldn't make up their mind which degree to give me, they informed me they wanted me to go to a dental school for 6 months on a refresher course and £800. I came to England with 10 shillings in my pocket. So that was out. So I switched. In Germany, when you train as a dentist, you also train as a technician. Or part of your... Yes. So I thought, well, the next best thing, be a technician. So I changed over, became a technician, got a job the same day when I came over. No, a week, wasn't it? A week later with Ted. About a week after I got here anyway. Got a job in a dental laboratory, became a technician. Subsequently, when charges were introduced in the health service, which was in 51, I believe, because originally it was all free, and charges were introduced, and work dropped off considerably then, when people had to pay for their things, so work dropped off. And I got the sack on Christmas Eve, have you? Yeah. Jobs were hard to come by in 1950, I believe it was, wasn't it?
I can't remember now, it was about that. Yeah,
about 1950. Jobs were hard to come by anyway. I finally got a job in a mental hospital as a nurse down St. Andrews. I stuck there for a week. I just could not carry on there. The patients, the way they were treated, it was terrible. Really terrible. Because they were mental patients. Anyway, I couldn't stand it any longer, so I left there without pay, because they didn't pay me for, sort of, I had to be paid a week in advance, like after a week's work. Anyway, I left there without pay, and I finally got a job in an iron foundry as a labourer in Norwich. I stayed there, how long? About 8 months, didn't I? Yeah. Stayed there about 8 months. They'd nearly finished me. I wasn't used to work like that. But anyway, it was work. And things improved then. People got used to the idea of paying for dental treatment. So things picked up. I advertised and got a job with a chap in the premises where my daughter now works. Anyway, that was there for a year or so. Went back to my original employer for another couple of years and then started on my own. Opened up my own dental laboratory, employed three people and did quite well, quite well.
This is in Norwich?
It's in Norwich, yes. I was on my own for about, 25 years, wasn't it, about that?
About 20.
Yeah, about 25 years I had my own laboratory, supplying different dentists with appliances of one kind or another, from as far afield as London.
So how did you come into contact with this man?
In the iron foundry, where I was a labourer. He was a, what they called a mixer of... I don't know if you know much about iron foundries, but they make cores out of sand, molasses, and anyway. In other words, molds and cores, they set into each other and then the metal is poured in. You leave a void to make a mold, in other words, and pour the metal in. And he was making the sand for making those molds, this chap. And my first job as a labourer was for the core maker, which I was attached to, I had to supply him with that sand, you see. So I had to get my barrow, go to this chap and get the sand. And as soon as I got there, I was speechless. It was him.
You recognized him?
I did indeed, immediately. I mean, he was built like a barn door, wasn't he? I couldn't forget that.
Did he remember you?
Not immediately. But when I spoke to him, he just looked at me. He said, were you ever in the Navy? So you could say that, yes. In the Atlantic? So yes, you can say that. U187, he said. So you got it. And that was it.
Had he saved any other U-boat crew?
Four.
In the same way?
Four members of our crew.
Using the same method?
Yeah. Yeah. We had four tubes at the front. They got out. The back, they got two tubes at the back as well. But they couldn't get out because the boat was sinking over the stern. It was sliding down over the stern, and they couldn't use those. I got out at the top. And simply, I only got out being a wireless operator, which is next door to the command room. By then, I was a nervous wreck anyway. I'm told I didn't show it, but I was. Watching the captain, as soon as he opened his mouth, abandoned ship. Roger Bannister had nothing on me. I was the first one there at the tube. I was out.
Well, why didn't the pressure of the sea crush you?
We were not that deep down. We did previously had to dive for our lives. We were being attacked by another destroyer, unconnected to this operation. We had to go down to 300 meters. Now, you have a plumb line when you dive in a U-boat, you know, through the boat, through the hull, plumb line. And as you dive down, if you watch that plumb line, you get more and more terrified because you can see the plumb line sagging. I mean, a U-boat, you imagine, is a tube. And all the innards is inside the tube. So the tube is flexible. And we went down and down and down, and that plumb line in the end was like this. What that means, if you're standing there in the gangway, which is only about that wide, if you are built like a barn door, you have to turn sideways because the engines and everything closes in on you. And that's was the other experience we had going down that deep. We got away with that one because we were lucky enough that the Atlantic we were in wasn't that deep at that point. We could lay on the bottom. And that means is then a command comes out. I don't know what it is in English now, but that means silence. You are hardly allowed to breathe. You aren't allowed to walk or not make a sound because they can hear you. And that means they couldn't find us. And we escaped. We were down there for 48 hours. You can imagine what the air was like in there. You could cut it with a knife. I mean, they say you can survive 72 hours because we have a kind of a filtration system. But 48 hours, and you were gasping, hanging near the top, gasping to get some air.
Did anybody become a nervous, have a nervous breakdown?
Yes. Yeah. To my knowledge, two. But I'm told to quite a number. I mean, I don't know if you call it a nervous breakdown, but they went hysterical.
So what did you do with them?
What do you do with them? You hit them. It calms them. Well, it doesn't calm them. It stops them from doing something silly. And all they got to do something silly, grab a valve or something and pull it and you all drown or whatever. It stops them. And the calmest one on board was a 17-year-old boy. I wasn't much older myself.